Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my coat.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Zibby Owens, the editor of On Being Jewish Now, a new anthology from Artists Against Anti-Semitism. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and l'shana tova tikatevu v'techa temu and gemar chatima tova. It's a new Jewish year, 5785, just 4 days old, which means we are in the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, the 10 days of repentance from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, the time between the Day of Judgment, Yom HaDin, and the conclusion of the appellate process on the Day of Atonement, Yom HaKippurim. This Jewish season is always a time of exaltation. That's why they call them the High Holy Days, but there is also a certain sense of pressure. We're in the midst of the 10 days of repentance, and we try to right the wrongs we have done over the past year and reconcile with anyone we have injured or offended. It's a challenge to heal our actions from the past 12 months. It is perhaps a greater challenge to try to change the habits we've fallen into that lead us to do things we are not proud of. Our goal during these days of awe is to look honestly at ourselves and to ask God to forgive us those failings we've committed over the past year, and so to again become whole. But as the Talmud tells us, for sins against God, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, atones, but for sins against other human beings, the Day of Atonement does not atone, until we have made atonement to them personally. God cannot heal the breaches in our relationship. Only we can do that by going to the people we've wronged and asking them to forgive us. So this is the most important time of year for us morally, a crucial period of reflection, self-examination, what Israelis call cheshbon ha-nefesh, taking an accounting of our souls. On Yom Kippur, the fast day of atonement, holiest day of the entire Jewish year, it begins Friday night at sundown, continuing until sundown Saturday night, we commit ourselves to try to repair our own world through repentance, prayer, and charity. Tshuva, tefillah, utzedakah. The melody that captures the essence of Yom Kippur is also the only melody that people come to temple just to hear. It's the Kol Nidre, the renunciation of failed vows, that commences the night of Yom Kippur. It's the melody that for many people captures the heart of the Jewish experience in just a few moments of music. Here's the great cantor Moshe Oysher's rendition of the beginning of the Kol Nidre.
Kol Nidre Me'asurei Shvei B'charmei B'kuinumei B'ichinu Yeah.
That was the remarkable Moshe Oysher's Kol Nidre for Yom Kippur, coming up this Friday night. Go to a synagogue near you to hear this most amazing melody. I'll be chanting it myself at our own temple, Congregation Beit Simcha, in the northwest of Tucson. And you can also hear on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org for details. Now, the chant of Kol Nidre is designed to bring us closer to what is holiest within us. At this time of atonement and return, we do well to remember as well that holiness begins for Jews with personal actions, mitzvot, not just words or professions of faith. The way to improve the world is by doing acts of goodness, blessing, and courage, not just talking about them, not even with God. That kind of action is what we dedicate ourselves to this week. Deeds that matter and improve the world. Nonetheless, we do need to ask God for help. And that's never more clear than in the Kol Nidre's soaring conclusion. Here's cantor and opera star Jan Pierce singing the end of the Kol Nidre. We could do a whole show on the melody of Kol Nidre, its many interpretations, famous stories about Kol Nidre Eve, jokes about Kol Nidre, and on. But the truth is, the only way to truly appreciate Kol Nidre is to hear it live in synagogue Friday night on the eve of Yom Kippur in a room filled with fervent prayer, soaring music, white clothing, prayer shawls, and the power of the Day of Atonement. It's a truly amazing experience, and it takes place just one night a year, Friday night, at a synagogue near you. If you can't be physically present, watch it and hear it on Facebook or YouTube or Zoom. You can join me in person if you want on Beit Simcha's Tucson Facebook page for this very special Kol Nidre experience, or in person at Congregation Beit Simcha. All of it is there. All of this Kol Nidre effort is there to bring us to tshuva, repentance, and help us learn how to work to heal injustice and brokenness in our lives and in our world. You can still be part of a wonderful community this High Holy Days. Arrange to attend Beit Simcha's beautiful Yom Kippur services. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. It's just 5 days until Yom Kippur. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is podcaster, author, publisher, and editor Zibby Owens of Artists Against Antisemitism. She has created a new anthology, a response to October 7th, which takes place tomorrow, the American calendar anniversary of that terrible atrocity. And rising antisemitism, well, that's responded to in this book. It's an affirmation of what being Jewish is all about today. It's called On Being Jewish Now. It's a fine read. Meet Zibby Owens when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people.
That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Zibby Owens is a author, podcaster, publisher, probably best known, well, I guess certainly best known for her podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. She's the author of a number of books and the editor of an important new anthology on being Jewish now. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the motivation for pulling this together.
I was feeling, I think, like so many other people, a little helpless, frustrated, wanting to help, not knowing how exactly. And I had helped start up an organization called Artists Against Antisemitism in the aftermath of October 7th and had a group chat going with all of those women authors who had co-founded the organization. And I don't know what it was that day at the end of June, but I was just like, there has to be something else that we can do. And then I thought, why not do an anthology? And I had already edited two anthologies in the past during the pandemic, and now I have a publishing house myself. So I thought, you know what? I can do this. Maybe it will help. And so that's how it started.
I hate to mention this, but you come from a pretty impressive background. How did that help you get started in doing all this?
I come from a long line of entrepreneurs and very hard workers, people who on both sides of my family are very committed to reading, the power of books, the power of education, the power of helping other people. And I think those values pervade everything that I do, including a project like this, to which I'm donating all profits to the organization Artists Against Antisemitism. So I think modeling giving back, modeling hard work, and modeling innovation.
Artists Against Antisemitism obviously arose, as you said, out of October 7th. But the book on being Jewish now isn't just about antisemitism at all. It's really about Jewish identity right now. Was that the intent originally, or did it kind of evolve?
No, the intent was very clear. I sent a note to everybody who was contributing it with some guidelines, and I said, this is not supposed to be political. This is a book about what being Jewish means to you, about the joy, about funny things in your life or sad things in your life, about food and family and, you know, bar mitzvahs and just what it all means and how it's all special. You know, I wanted it to almost be a time capsule of the celebration of Jewish life and Jewish joy and also Jewish trauma and what it means and how everything has changed since October 7th, but also not. So a lot of the essays have nothing at all to do with that and little to do with anti-Semitism, but many talk about all of it all at once, which of course is the Jewish experience, right? The pain and the joy and the humor, all of it wrapped up at once.
And also the way things are different now than they were for your parents, for your friends, even for you earlier. By the way, one of the most startling ones, Jeremy Gorelick wrote a piece about walking into a gun shop. Very surprising, not what I expected to find in this anthology.
Yeah, he was terrified in the aftermath and felt like he might need to protect himself and didn't expect to find himself there either, but felt like, you know, the world was coming to an end. And, you know, he comes from a long line of survivors and wanted to be practical in how he handled things. Obviously, has not had to.
No, fortunately not. But there's a funny line in that. He says, you know, what kind of gun are you looking for? The shop owner says, and he says, we're Jewish. He said, okay, so you want a Beretta and a shotgun? Like, oh, I guess. We will talk much more with Zibby Owens. Her new book is called On Being Jewish Now, and it's terrific and timely and right to the point. When we come back in just a moment here on Two Jewish. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity.
Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
You know, we played a couple of outstanding renditions of Kol Nidre in the first part of the show, but I'd be remiss if I omitted my least favorite Kol Nidres of all time. This is a favorite section for so many listeners of Too Jewish. In the mid-20th century, Jews with a strong connection to their heritage represented a disproportionate percentage of the record-buying public. Producing a record they would be interested in was important back then. Perhaps that explains why, well, some unusual people recorded Kol Nidre. The sleepiest singer of all time, Italian Catholic crooner Perry Como, recorded the following rendition of Kol Nidre. If you think you have trouble staying awake during sermons, try it when this is the most dramatic piece of music in the whole service.
Kol Nidre. Vesole ushvue vacharome vekonome vekenose vahi.
Very relaxed, but frankly, that rendition of Kol Nidre was nowhere near as terrible as the very worst Kol Nidre ever sung. Here it is, Johnny Mathis, of all people, warbling his way through the Kol Nidre. Chances are the Kol Nidre lost the battle.
Kol Nidre. Yeah.
Yeesh. Nothing like Johnny Mathis mumbling and sliding and trembling through Kol Nidre, singing vaguely recognizable versions of the actual Aramaic words to make you feel introspective, or perhaps the way you feel after fasting for a lot of hours, a little bit sick to your stomach. Well, if in spite of my less than stellar recommendation, if you liked that Kol Nidre, definitely look up Johnny Mathis' version of Eli Eli on YouTube. Not for the faint of heart. Or perhaps you prefer Neil Diamond's rendition from the final movie version of The Jazz Singer. I assume they figured you can't possibly make another movie like this after this version. Well, at least Neil Diamond is Jewish. We all need something to atone for on Yom Kippur, right? Like killing Kol Nidre vocally? Actually, watching the YouTube clip, it was nice to see an old family friend, Cantor Uri Frankel of blessed memory, chanting the Kol Nidre just before Neil Diamond took over. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you just came back from your hometown, St. Louis.
Right.
Which is a place I know really almost nothing about. I've never really spent any time there. Except one thing I do know is because I lived in Cincinnati and I know a little bit about the Jewish communities in the Midwest, is that it had a significant German Jewish population very early for American cities when it was kind of the gateway to the West. But that's not where your family's from. Tell us a little bit about sort of the ethnic makeup of what was originally the St. Louis Jewish community.
So it's very interesting because you're right that the earliest immigrants there were Germans and largely Reformed Jews who founded some big temples that still exist, you know, 160 years later or 180 years later.
Right. They came after failed revolutions in Germany usually and, you know, wanted
in some
a more
cases
liberal
following
place.
1848. My shul is celebrating its 140th anniversary this year, and it was always much more diverse. My family on one side is Russian, on the other side is Hungarian. We don't have a drop of German blood. I mean, Austro-Hungarian is the closest we get, but it's really Hungarian. So there are a lot of funny things we just discussed off air about this subject of how each major Jewish community in America has its own characteristics, its own ethnic diversity, its own qualities. But one of the things that typifies St. Louis. So I was there for the long weekend, and on Sunday I had brunch with a childhood friend who is a major force in my synagogue. His father is a past president, as was mine. Our parents were good friends. His mother went to Hebrew school with my father. His grandmother played volleyball with my grandmother in the 1920s at the mother's club of the grade school that the two kids went to. So, you know, Gary's grandma, Gary's parents, Gary, his kids, and grandkids are all friends of mine. And this is quite typical in St. Louis that two Jews will get together and their families will have been friends for four or five generations, often in the same synagogue. And there's a very high degree of affiliation and synagogue membership and synagogue participation. What has changed a little is that people affiliate with Judaism in different ways. It's less synagogue-based than it was 50 years ago, certainly less than 100 years ago. For example, the number of conservative, major conservative synagogues in St. Louis has declined from 3 to 2 over the past 50 years.
Well, and that mirrors a trend across the nation for the conservative movement, certainly.
Right. But I don't think the Reform movement has done any better in St. Louis in terms of, it's certainly not growing. And the number of congregations may have shrunk
also
slightly from many
right.
to Still many, but not smaller
as
many.
Yeah, right. less than as many.
What right. has grown is the number of Orthodox congregations. A lot of them are little storefront synagogues and shtiblach, but there's a lot of those in St. Louis. But it is interesting. I mean, so you grew up in L.A.
I did.
And L.A. has a very different history. And it's interesting to speculate how much the Jewish communities we know today in our country reflect the people who created them 100 or 150 years ago, and how much they reflect some of the great rabbis who have graced these communities over the past 100 or 150 years, and how much reflects just the ethnic differences of the waves of immigration that came throughout the 19th century.
We can explore that in more detail next time. I mean, definitely it affected things. And then how that's changed rather dramatically in the last, in my view, 20 or 30 years. We will talk next week. Tom, thanks so much. And again, L'Shana Tova.
And to you. Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Stanley's having coffee in his palatial home, and there's a knock on the door. It's the rabbi. He says, "Stanley, we have an important new initiative for the synagogue. We're building a preschool that will ensure the future of our community. Stanley, we really need your help financially in a significant way." Stanley replies, "Rabbi, I got a kid in college. He wants to go to law school. I got another kid in college, and she wants to go to medical school. I have a cousin on the verge of bankruptcy who needs a bridge loan or his whole life is going to fall apart. I have an aunt who needs a life-saving operation. Rabbi, if I can say no to them, I can say no to you, too." Yep, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. No, I think I knew that guy. And now a word of Torah. This Shabbat is more than just the regular Sabbath. It's the Shabbat Shabbaton, the great Sabbath of Sabbaths, Yom Kippur, Yom HaKippurim. On this holiest day of the year, the Day of Atonement, we Reform Jews have not one, but two Torah readings, Nitzavim, the same portion from Deuteronomy we read just before Rosh Hashanah, and a selection from the middle of the Torah in Leviticus, Kedoshim. While, atypically for Judaism, all Jews agree on what portion of the Torah is read for almost every ritual occasion, on Yom Kippur, there is a significant difference of opinion as to what section should be read from the Torah. On the morning of the Day of Atonement, Orthodox and Conservative congregations read a description of the rites of sacrificing animals on the Day of Atonement. Back in the days when this temple stood in Jerusalem nearly 2,000 years ago, and then they follow that with the obscure and interesting ritual of the scapegoat. Their afternoon reading is a long listing of the kinds of sexual immorality forbidden by the Torah. The Torah portion that describes the ritual of the scapegoat is fascinating. The term scapegoat has become part of our regular English lexicon, of course, but it was a real live animal in biblical times. At the time of Yom Kippur, in the course of preparing burnt offerings to place on the altar of the temple in Jerusalem, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, would select two goats. One was marked for God, the other for Azazel, a kind of codename for that which is unholy, that in other religions later came to represent the devil. The goat marked for God, like the bull and other animals designated for ritual sacrifice, was slaughtered and roasted on the altar, a normal procedure in the worship traditions of that day. But the goat marked for Azazel had a different career ahead. Instead of being sacrificed in the regular way to expiate the sins of the people and seek forgiveness, it would instead be led out into the Judean desert, not very far from Jerusalem, by the way. You can look east and see it. There on a mountaintop, the ritual continued. The high priest would place his hand on the goat and symbolically transfer the sins of the people to the goat. And that goat, uninjured other than by the moral weight that had been placed on its horny head, would be set free to wander the wilderness. The scapegoat, through no fault of its own, carried the sins of the Israelites out of the land, but it would remain essentially unharmed, an enduring symbol of the errors of our people. The term scapegoat, of course, has remained with us, a representation of the poor schnook tossed out by more powerful higher-ups to take the fall for their own sins. We still have such scapegoats today, of course, every staffer sacrificed on behalf of his superior or her superior is a kind of fulfillment of this scapegoat routine. So, why is this ritual in the Torah? The message is a little obscure. While the essence of Yom Kippur is the concept of personal responsibility, the scapegoat implies that even on a day dedicated to self-examination and atonement, it helps to know some sins can be passed off on a lesser creature. Or perhaps the idea is simply we need to know that there is some ritual that will release us from our failures, even though we know that we will remain always fallible and human, even after all the atonements of Yom Kippur. Now, the Torah readings in the Reformed Jewish tradition are different. In the morning, we chant the great Torah portion of Nitzavim, Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem. You stand here today, all of you, from richest to poorest, the most exalted to the humblest, and the Lord your God presents you with a great and sacred choice. You can either choose to follow the mitzvot, to live a life of morality and dedication to ethics and goodness, or you can sin again and stray from God. That choice is really between spiritual life and spiritual death. The choice is always yours to make. Choose life, uvacharta v'chaim, that you and your children may live long and flourish. The afternoon reading from Kedoshim reaffirms this in practical ways, teaching us how to choose life. Be holy, honor our parents, assist the poor, welcome the stranger, protect the physically and mentally challenged, be just in conduct, observe the Shabbat, do not hate others in our hearts, love our neighbor as we love ourselves. In other words, accept responsibility, choose to act with holiness and goodness, and live by the commandments. Great readings on our greatest day next Shabbat. When we come back in a moment, author, editor, publisher, and podcaster Zibby Owens shares the origins and meaning of the excellent new anthology on Being Jewish Now, both a response to October 7th and to the rise in anti-Semitism. She's the creator of Artists Against Anti-Semitism. But it's also an affirmation of Jewishness in 2024. Hear all about it when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Israeli military struck the terrorists of Hezbollah in Lebanon with tremendous effectiveness last week, disabling its entire command and control, shockingly killing its murderous longtime leader, Hassan Nasrallah. His death should not be mourned. Nasrallah had a great deal of American blood on his hands, as well as a long history of murderous action against Syrian and Lebanese civilians, and, of course, leading many attacks on Israelis and other Jews. After a lightning campaign of air attacks directed by extraordinarily effective advanced military intelligence, Israel knocked out a shocking number of commanders of Hezbollah, wiped out a decent percentage of its missile capacity, and then entered southern Lebanon to continue its work on the ground. Hezbollah, for the moment, has been exposed as perhaps something of a paper tiger. For years, Hezbollah has been regarded as the best-armed and most dangerous non-state military in the entire world. That apparently does not make them much of an opponent for the IDF. Hezbollah has been Iran's biggest client terrorist proxy in the area, ready to attack Israel at any moment, supposedly. Hezbollah's steady rain of rockets on the north of Israel has forced about 70,000 Israelis, some put the number higher, to evacuate their homes for an entire year. That low level, only in the Middle East would rockets falling on your house be considered low-level war. That quote-unquote low level of conflict changed dramatically when Israel decided to act. Lebanon has been teetering on the brink of being a failed state for years, in part because of the incredibly destabilizing effect of the large Hezbollah terrorist military, which controls the south of the country and is, frankly, more powerful than the Lebanese army. In response to the Hezbollah wipeout by Israel, Iran launched 200 ballistic missiles directly at Israel, all of which failed to cause any serious casualties. It makes you wonder just what Iran is doing now. Is it merely trying to shore up its proxies without provoking a direct Israeli retaliation? Since Israel has demonstrated it can kill people in the middle of Tehran if it wants to, is this the best Iran can do, or is it just sandbagging? Time will certainly tell, but for the moment, at the beginning of this Jewish year, 5785, Israel has seized back the military initiative from its Iranian Islamist enemy and its many terrorist proxies. In other news, a man who attempted to murder two Jews leaving synagogue in Los Angeles on consecutive days last year has been sentenced to 35 years in prison. Jaime Tran, a former California resident and dental student, pleaded guilty in June to two counts of hate crimes with intent to kill and two counts of using, carrying, and discharging a firearm in relation to a crime of violence, the Justice Department said. In February 2023, Tran drove to Pico Robertson, a heavily Jewish neighborhood in L.A., one where I grew up, personally, in search of Jewish victims. He shot a man leaving a synagogue wearing a kippah. The next morning, Tran shot another man wearing a kippah, leaving a different synagogue nearby. Both victims were injured in the attacks and survived. Tran was arrested 2 days later. The Jewish Federation of L.A. said it is grateful for today's sentencing of the perpetrator responsible for the 2023 anti-Semitic shooting in the Pico Robertson area of Los Angeles, which targeted members of the Jewish community. We hope today's decision helps to bring closure to the victims and their families and makes our broader Jewish community feel protected. According to the indictment, Tran had a long history of making violent anti-Semitic comments and threats. In the months leading up to his attacks, he repeatedly called and texted a former classmate, sending messages like, "Someone is going to kill you, Jew," repeatedly, and "burn in an oven chamber." As of 2023, Tran was prohibited from buying firearms due to previous mental health holds, according to the Justice Department, but around mid-February 2023, he acquired at least two guns using an intermediary and used the internet to research locations that had a kosher market. Attorney General Merrick Garland, who is Jewish, said vile acts of anti-Semitic hatred endanger the safety of individuals and whole communities. Allowing such crimes to go unchecked endangers the foundation of our democracy itself. Merrick Garland also alluded to rising rates of anti-Semitism in the years since Hamas's October 7, 2023 terrorist atrocities launched the war in Gaza. As millions of Jewish Americans prepare to observe the High Holy Days, the Justice Department reaffirms its commitment to aggressively confront, disrupt, and prosecute criminal acts motivated by anti-Semitism or hatred of any kind. No Jewish person in America should have to fear that any sign of their identity will make them the victim of a hate crime, said Garland. Amen. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World.
Our brothers, laws of Israel.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Zibby Owens is a best-selling author, podcaster, publisher, best known, at least until she did this new book called On Being Jewish Now, for her very widely listened to podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. She is the author of Princess Charming, Blank, a novel that came out just this year, Bookends, a memoir of love, loss, and literature, and a couple of Moms Don't Have Time to books, as well as some other stuff. What was the most surprising thing to emerge as you put together this anthology?
One of the surprising things was how similar people's experiences were. I was, even though the people contributing are quite diverse, you know, we have a Black and Jewish man, we have someone who converted to Judaism, half Jewish, you know, Jews from all over the world, from Israel, from New York. So as a group, the contributors are quite diverse, but I felt that at the heart of it, the experiences were just so similar. The fears were so similar, not knowing whether it was okay for people's kids to wear Jewish jewelry right now. Should we right. embrace it or not? Like things like that. Some of deep down, and I guess it's not such a shock, but it just made me feel incredibly connected to everybody else, knowing that so many sentiments were just so similar.
I was pleasantly surprised by how many people said in their essays how much prouder they were to be Jewish, or this is the most proud they've ever been to be Jewish.
Yes. Pride, connection, and the determination to sort of uplift the values of Judaism right, to show who we are and how great we are as a people, not in terms of bragging, but the good things, the things that make us who we are. People felt renewed determination to just exhibit those great traits.
What's the funniest story in here?
I really liked Mark Feuerstein's essay called Electric Jugaloo about his dancing, breakdancing at his bar mitzvah back in the day and then doing it as a sort of middle-aged dad for his kids. That made me laugh.
There are a lot of funny ones there. Although my favorite title is probably Amy Efron's I Once Had a Fight with a Moyle. It seems like a dangerous thing to do. He's got a knife. It's a very small knife, however.
Yes, that's true.
How did you choose who was going to be involved? Did you open it up to everybody, all of the artists against anti-Semitism?
I opened it up to the founding members team, everybody who was on that group chat. I think there were about 25 women on that. Not everybody could contribute. The timeline was incredibly tight because I only thought of this on June 30th and knew I had to get something out by October 1st in advance of the anniversary so I could provide some sort of solace to people going through that with these words. I asked about 200 authors, everybody I could think of, also people who the other contributors invited, some of whom I didn't even know. And I didn't like put it up on Instagram or anything because it was sort of a secret underground project for a little bit. But people who had been on my podcast as guests, people I'd been watching on Instagram, things like that. And the people who did step up and say, yes, I can write this essay within 3 weeks, despite all the other things going on in my life, they basically jumped up and said, yes, and what else can I do? And that attitude has really pervaded everything else. We now have a group chat ourselves, and everybody is just so excited to help and do something after feeling
helpless. Yeah.
Helpless for so long. Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing to be in Israel where you feel like there's, I mean, as unbelievably challenging as it is there now, you could do something, you know, you can physically help. It's very different to think, oh, all I could do is send a check from America or something and look around and not be sure what to do. Just a technical question. Putting it in an anthology, you set up rules, how long everything can be. How difficult is that to enforce?
Some were longer than others. I didn't really enforce it too much. I used it more as a rule of thumb. I'm of the belief that people need as much time as they need to tell their stories. I definitely cut some a lot, but I don't think it was too hard. I think the people writing are all published authors or public figures who are used to writing on deadline and writing for publication. So that was very helpful.
Okay, this is a really terrible question. What's your favorite piece in here?
Well, different ones have different meanings. There are interesting ones like stories Emily Tisch Sussman tells about celebrating Hanukkah for 29 nights and how she just didn't want to stop celebrating once her kids basically got a hold of it. Then there Jane Rosen writes about, you know, visiting all these great Lower East Side Jewish institutions and how she, you know, she was shopping as a child and basically takes us back historically. Then we move to Judy Battalion's essay where she's not sure about the security, talking in the aftermath of October 7th at a big public forum, and is it going to be okay, and how she felt about it, and then how she gets up and does it. And it gives me goosebumps when people like sort of work through some of that tough stuff. Samantha Edis writes about her son's bar mitzvah being that same weekend.
Yeah, same Shabbat. Right.
Oh, my goodness. And then another one I found just so powerful was Lihi Lapid's essay, To Be an Israeli Mom, which was written very poetically and talked about what that particular lived experience feels like, which also just gave me goosebumps, made me cry. I mean, they're all so good, but those are just a few off the top of my head.
They really are, I don't mean surprisingly good. I mean, they really range across the spectrum, but not in quality. You know, sometimes in anthologies, some stuff's great, some stuff, you know, it's okay. The level of writing is really extremely high. Do you think that was because of the prompt?
I think it was, and I'm grateful you say that. Thank you. I haven't talked to too many people who have read the whole thing, aside from people on my team and all the contributors, so it's nice to have that reinforced.
By the way, it reads well. I mean, it reads quickly. It's not, you know, you don't feel like you're slogging through at any point, and maybe that's because of the, I mean, it's very fresh.
No, I'm glad to hear that, and I tried to also make a lot of different sections so that you could read a couple at once and then sort of move on to a new section of themes and everything, so it's not just like one essay after another, but that there's a point to some of them. I think the writing is good because these are really great writers. They're, as I said, most of them are authors, published authors, whose books I've read and have really enjoyed. And I spent a lot of time, I edited every essay myself, and then, you know, had another editor at my company read and edit, and we wanted to make sure that, and then we had it all copy edited and then proofread, and we want to make sure that every essay is the best it could be. So we definitely did a bunch of editing to really fine tune and perfect, I guess, but the raw material was there and very good.
I should note that a lot of these authors are past guests of Too Jewish, including half of the rabbis you quote, you anthologize. So that shouldn't be such a surprise.
I saw many friends and past guests of mine on your list.
Well, I mean, there are really an unbelievable wealth of terrific Jewish writers today. This is a peculiar question. Artists against anti-Semitism, they don't have to be Jewish, do they?
No, of course not. It's anybody who wants to stand up against hate and stand up against, you know, unfair treatment of any group. And, you know, we're trying to educate and make people more tolerant and understand and help college students and all of that. So, yeah, no, not just Jewish people at all.
Shifting gears a little bit, tell us how you decided to start your podcast originally.
I actually started the podcast at the advice of a friend when I was trying to sell a book myself. I wanted to sell a collection of essays called Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books, and the agents I pitched it to were not finding it funny. And my friend, who's a big deal middle grade author, Sarah Mlynowski, she said, "No, I don't think that's the right project for you, but I think you should start a podcast." I was like, "Why would I start a podcast? I didn't have a platform. I had stayed home with my kids for 11 years, even though I started writing for magazines when I was 14 and had freelanced a ton and written, like ghostwritten a book and done a bunch of other work. I wasn't on social media. I was a nobody. It didn't count." And she said, "Try that." And I thought, okay, well, I'm not even going to tell anybody about it. And I'll just interview authors who I love and am so grateful for as a lifelong reader. And I started by interviewing one of my good friends from business school, Lee Carpenter, who's a novelist. And I realized I learned more things about listening to her talk in half an hour than I had in like our whole friendship, even though we'd had coffees and dinners and all that. So I just fell in love with it. And I still am in love with it. Before I talked to you today, I did 5 back-to-back podcasts with different authors, including Alice Hoffman. And no, it doesn't get old. I love it. I really love it.
I've been doing this show for, I don't know, 21 years or something. And I love talking to everybody Jewish that's doing interesting things, but maybe authors are the ones who come closest to the spirit of Judaism, which is so, I don't know, literate. Tell us, in putting together this anthology and getting it out there, and you're donating all the profits from it to Artists Against Anti-Semitism, what's going to be the next step for Artists Against Anti-Semitism? It doesn't seem like anti-Semitism is going down right now, shall we say.
I mean, our belief is education and reaching people to just let them know, work on it. We're raising money through silent auctions. We're working with Shema, which works with college campuses to, you know, teach people the dangers of anti-Semitism. And no, it doesn't feel like it's going away, but that doesn't mean we can just sit by and let it fester. I mean, we have to try, and that's what this organization is all about.
What's your next book going to be?
My next book is another novel, which I just turned in and goes to copy edit in December. It comes out exactly a year from now, October 1st, 2025. I just got my pub date, very excited. It's called Overheard, and it's about a bookstore owner, and I'm also a bookstore owner, so that's really fun. But it's about a bookstore owner in Santa Monica, and her ex-husband wants to introduce the kids to his new fiance, who it turns out is a big, huge movie star. And then when the bookstore owner starts talking badly about her to a friend at the neighborhood football game, it gets picked up by the live stream and gets broadcast to the whole community, and she gets canceled. And the rest of the book is about how she tries to get back in the good graces of the community with the help of her kids.
It's a tshuva book, we would say. It's good that it's coming out around, you know, holiday time next year. By the way, I wanted to ask you about that. It's a little quixotic to open a bookstore these days, isn't it?
It is. And I love it. It's been a dream. I love print books. I love, there's nothing more. I mean, I could spend all day every day in a bookstore. That's like my happy place. And I thought maybe I could do it. And I'm doing it. It's really amazing. And I've curated the books along with my team in a unique way, since I'm not always there myself, where each shelf is sort of recommendations on a different type of emotion or topic, like motherhood malaise or reeling from divorce or insomnia, or just funny categories designed to improve the discoverability of different books, which I think is really, really hard in today's jam-packed marketing sort of book world. So it's great. It's really helped the community, and we have author events all the time, and it is my pride and joy.
Well, you have a lot of things to be proud of. Zibby, where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about Artists Against Anti-Semitism, and in particular, to find out more about On Being Jewish Now?
Yes, you can go to zibbymedia.com, zibbymedia.com. We have the book right on our homepage and all the other things we do, from the other books we publish to retreats to the bookstore to my podcast. You can follow me on Instagram, where I spend way too much time, at Zibby Owens. And you can follow me on Substack, where I have a weekly blog newsletter. ZibbyOwens.substack.com. And just Google me.
Zibby, thank you so much. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways, and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Elliot Abrams, a shaper of U.S. foreign policy in two U.S. presidential administrations, and the author of a new book, If You Will It, Rebuilding Jewish Peoplehood for the 21st Century. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night for services in Onik Shabbat, and Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study and 10 a.m. services, Torah reading in Kiddush, live in person on our Facebook page. Most importantly, this Friday night and Saturday are Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, October 11th and 12th. Services are at 6 p.m. Friday and 9:30 a.m. Saturday. Call Beit Simcha 520-276-5675 or go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to join us for Yom Kippur. Play out this morning comes from Ne'ilah, the concluding service on Yom Kippur this coming Saturday evening. The Sephardic piyut, the liturgical poem El Nora Alilah, is performed by Chazan Ari Litvak and his friends. My friends, may you have a Lishana Tova Metuka, a good and a sweet year, an easy fast, a Tzom Kal. May you be sealed in the Book of Life for a good year, Gmar Chatima Tova, and have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week and a year, we pray profoundly, of justice and peace.
El Nora Alila, El Nora Alila, Hamzilanu Mechila, בשעת הנעילה אל נורא לילה אל נורא לילה המציא לנו מחילה בשעת הנעילה
מתם מספר קרועים לחיים נושאים ומסלדים בחילה בשעת הנעילה
אל נורא לילה
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.